We are celebrating the 20th anniversary of the World Cafe throughout the month of October, digging up the best of our archived interviews. And today it's a trip through the world of bluegrass and country. As one half of the famous 1950s duo, the Louvin Brothers, with his brother Ira, Charlie Louvin was inspired by Appalachian folk music performers like the Delmore Brothers and the Blue Sky Boys. Joining Nashville's Grand Ole Opry in 1955, the Louvin Brothers stayed there until 1963, when they broke up in the face of a number of pressures, most notably the popularity of that newfangled rock and roll. Sadly, 2 years later in 1965, Charlie's brother Ira died in a car crash. In 2007, Charlie Louvin put out his first new studio album in over 10 years. The self-titled disc featured a number of songs in classic Louvin Brothers style. When he came by our studios around the time of its release, I asked Charlie about the Southern gospel tradition of shape note singing.
Now, did you and your brother shape your harmonies after the shape note singing or after people like the Delmores?
No, we... Singing wise, we wasn't close to the Delmores, but we heard a lot of stuff at those singings. You know, they have five part harmony, not just four.
Wow!
And one of the girls would do the what they call the alto part, and that intrigued my brother. A lot of times, he would use that part instead of first tenor, because people would ask him, "What is that? What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, you don't like it?" I said, "No, I didn't say that. I just want to know what it is." He said, "I don't know what it is, but I thought it'd work, so I threw it in there." But we learned a lot from listening to those folks sing.
Well, that would explain why I heard the story that Emmylou Harris, when she heard you and your brother sing for the first time, said, "Who's the girl singing up on top?" He was singing the alto part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my brother had I'm sure he had a falsetto. He never did have to use it, because I never did sing high enough to force him to go falsetto, but he could sing awful high.
If I cry when I kiss you, when we say goodbye, don't laugh, don't laugh. If I say I've always loved you, and I will till I die, don't laugh, don't laugh. I couldn't ever find another, there's no use for me to try. I beg of you, my darling, please don't laugh if I cry. If I say I've always loved you, and I will till I die, don't laugh, don't laugh.
One of the biggest hurdles for you guys, for the Louvin Brothers to get over, was to get hired by the Opry. Was that tough at the time? Because you guys were doing fairly well, I thought.
We were doing quite well in gospel music.
Oh, okay.
But we was going to quit the business if we couldn't get on the Opry. That was our plan. And so I said, let me call Ken Nelson. We'd never bugged him. He was our producer, A&R man. And I called him. I said, do you know anybody at the Opry? Well, he said, I know Jack Stapp. That was the boss. And I said, well, Larry and I are going to hang it up if we can't get on the Opry. And I thought maybe you might could help. So he said, I'll call you back. Give me your number. And I said, I'm at a payphone on the street, and I'll stay here till you call back. So he called Jack Stapp. And I don't know what Jack Stapp said after Ken said, I've got a duet on my label that I would like to have on the Opry. And then Jack said something, and Ken said, if you don't want them, the Ozark Jubilee does. And Jack said, we don't need anybody else slipping off to Springfield, so just tell them they're on this Friday night. That was on a Tuesday. So we were never guests on the Opry or anything until we became members.
Throughout your career, you of course originally sang gospel and then started singing more secular songs. Was that a problem? Was that a problem at the time? Did the gospel community, how did they feel about that?
Well, we didn't get a chance to ask many of them, but the gospel people really didn't like us. So they just had a piano in the quartet, you know, and we were, as they mentioned, we were a carnival act.
Because you were a string, because you had guitar?
Oh. Right. They just never did read the book. Our strings is mentioned in that book. But they didn't really take to us too good. So And on our road shows, we did a mixture of shows, supposedly funny songs, love songs, and gospel songs. And that's what we wanted to do on record. And finally talked them into that, and we came with When I Stopped Dreaming as our first secular tune for Capitol.
And that didn't fare too badly, so.
Well, it's probably the most remembered song of all the Leuven Brothers songs.
But when you go out and do a show now, what's the most requested? Because I heard you mention in Knoxville Girl, something you can't get away without doing.
That's it.
Really?
The Knoxville Girl was, even when we had a number one record on I Don't Believe You've Met My Baby, we go do a program. And the third song, by the time you got through doing the third song, somebody in the audience would holler for the Knoxville Girl. And you couldn't get by without doing the Knoxville Girl on each show. Hmm. It's a gruesome piece of literature, isn't it?
Well, let me try that. Knoxville Girl. Is it going to work?
Well, we can do anything. We can do anything. If you want to hear some Knoxville Girl.
I'd love to.
It's an E chord.
E?
It's... Actually, we're changing the schedule just a little bit, but we're
sorry.
Very adaptable in this little aggregation. Lord, I met a little girl in Knoxville, in the town we all know well. Every Sunday out in her home I dwell. We went to take an evening walk about a mile from town. And I picked the stick up off the ground and knocked that fair girl down. She fell down on her bended knees. For mercy she did cry. Oh, Willie dear, don't kill me here, I'm unprepared to die. She never spoke another word, I only beat her more. Until the ground around me within her blood. Then I took her by her golden curls, and I drug her round and round, throwing her into the river that flows through Knoxville town. Go down, you Knoxville girl with the dark and roving eyes. Go down, you Knoxville girl, you could never be my bride. Then I started back to Knoxville, got there about midnight. My mama, she was worried and woke up in a fright, saying, dear son, what have you done to bloody your clothes so? And I told my nosy mother I was bleeding at my nose. Back then, David, crime wasn't near as profitable as it is today, so I'm going to skip part of the song. I'll just sing you the Dick Tracy part of it, the last verse. They carried me down to Knoxville, put me in a cell. My friends all tried to get me out, but none could go my bail. So I'm here to waste my life away down in this dirty old jail. Because I murdered that Knoxville girl, the girl I love so. That's a killer, David.
Literally and in every way. That's Charlie Louvin doing Knoxville Girl. Thanks for that. People don't usually do my requests, so I appreciate that. Makes me feel better. There's a younger generation of folks who work around here, and I was kind of just trying to describe your career and where it all came from. And I said, people, you have to understand that Elvis Presley opened for the Louvin Brothers. But I understand that was a Hank Snow show, or was that your show, or how did that work out?
Well, we were pretty warm at the time.
I'll bet.
And Mr. Parker needed somebody to get the people in the building. And they didn't really, and I didn't either. I didn't know what Elvis was doing there at first. You know, I thought he was a fad. Huh. Most people thought that Elvis was just a fad. It would go away. But my wife is from Memphis, so we was on a visit once and carried Elvis's mother one of the Louvin gospel albums. She loved those. And I seen a woman older than my mother out on her knees outside the fence in the front of Elvis's house, reaching through, picking grass like a goat, saving that grass to take it back home and show people, you know, be like carrying a glass of water saying, Elvis drank out of this cup. But she was actually pulling grass and saving it. And I knew then it wasn't a fad. It caught on.
Now, did as rock and roll broke in the 50s, was that tough for the Louvins?
Well, we got through it. We just stuck to our guns at that time. But a lot of people put out of business, David. It killed Webb Pierce and Carl Smith. They never recorded again. Mm. Elvis changed the entire music industry, and it. But country always comes back. It's gotten sick and had to go to bed, but somebody will doctor it, and it always comes back. There'll always be country music.
Charlie Louvin from an interview recorded back in 2007. At the time, he had just released his first new studio album in a decade. Charlie Louvin passed away on January 26th of this year. He was 83. Later, we'll hear from the legendary Merle Haggard, but first, the Smoky Mountain Songbird, Dolly Parton. Hear her in a moment on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe. To close out the 20th anniversary hour here on the World Cafe, we're joined by one final country legend, Merle Haggard. He helped define the Bakersfield sound, the type of country music that originated in Bakersfield, California in the 50s. While Nashville was becoming famous for slick production and orchestral strings, people like Haggard and Buck Owens were combining hardcore honky-tonk with the sound of Fender Telecasters to create music with much rougher edges. While he had many, many hits, Haggard earned a particularly great amount of attention for his 1969 song, Okie from Muskogee. The lyrics attacked the hippie movement and struck a chord with many Americans. He has continued to actively record over the decades, creating a body of work that has clearly influenced the generations of country artists that have followed him. When we visited Merle Haggard backstage in 2003, he had just released the album Like Never Before, but we began the interview talking about the beginning of his career. I asked him what it was like when he first met his hero, honky-tonk singer Lefty Frizzell.
I was 16 years old, and he was passing through town and saw some promise, I guess, or something with me, and he let me go out and sing with his band and his guitar and everything. You know, it's like the greatest thing in the world that could have happened, because when I saw that his audience liked me, then I knew I had a solid chance. And yeah. nobody, was an evaluation for me. And years went by, and then I met Lefty on a different level. I was having hit records, and he said, "You're that kid from Bakersfield, aren't you?"
He remembered that.
Yeah. We went on to become real close friends, which is something that happens, one out of 10 million times, who gets to be friends with their hero, you know?
Seriously, yes. Do you remember what you played for him? Was it one of your own songs?
No, I think so. Let's see. No. Let's see. I was a stranger passing through your town. Lord, I was a stranger passing through your town. When I asked you a favor, good gal, you turned me down. Lord, I love the L&N. Lord, I love the L&N. And if the police don't get me, I'm gonna ride them again. 'Cause I was a stranger,
yeah.
Jimmy Rogers tune, and I did another thing that I think was I woke up this morning in a terrible mood. Talk about a woman treating a good man rude. They had me talking to myself, walking down that mean old wall. You had another daddy waiting down at the end of the hall. He said, he stopped me, he said, "Listen, would you like to go out and sing with my band, you know?"
Wow.
And handed me his guitar, changed my life.
Just hearing you do these songs brings me in mind of, you know, one of the reasons why I love your music so much is something about being from California, where the California and the country music, and your interest in music, be it Bob Wills, Jimmy Rogers, there is this whole influence of blues and jazz on what you do.
Yeah, it was installed in my young life by my parents. They liked a wide array of music, mm-hmm. and we listened to everybody, I think, that most everybody else listened to, and had no boundaries like it does now. You know, you listen to Crosby, and Louis Armstrong was with him, and Jack Teagarden, and, you know, and that's what I heard as a child. I remember Bing's records being big, and Bob Wills and Tommy Duncan, you know, mm-hmm. and they were actually in the studios out in the West, when records was considered a less than acceptable software, you know, and the old 78s. Well, they would actually make broadcasts and transcriptions, you know, in the mid 40s and stuff of that nature. And I can remember those real broadcasts.
Wow.
And they were down in the, you know, telling about where they're going to be in Fresno the next night, Modesto, and somewhere else. And Bob would talk, and it was like listening to Lum and Abner and all that. You know, it was just unbelievable. Everything was live. What's the guy's name? Arthur Godfrey, that sit mm-hmm. there with a guitar and did basically what we're doing here, just mm-hmm. rambled around and played music. And he was live every day, you know. It was like Rush Limbaugh with a guitar, you know.
Well, that's a good way to put it. You know, that's so exciting to me. Now, did you have a chance as a kid, or did your parents have a chance to see, would Bob Wills play dances?
They did, but only a part of my family would go, because they were religious, you know, and dancing was considered sinful.
Mm.
And so only somebody in the family that was 18 or 20 years old that snuck off and went to the dance was able to come back and tell us about it, you know. And I was probably, before 12, I was like wishing I could go to the dance, and I think I rode a bicycle out to one of Bob's dances when I was about 11 or 12, and they had these old canvas windows that you could hold up Mm-hmm. They're like shutters, like storm shutters. Well, that old dance hall had that. It was way up high above your head, but I could stand on my bicycle and look inside, and I seen Wills and the Playboys, you know, and it was back in their heyday, you know, and they had this great band. And it was, I'd slipped out of the house, and my mother thought I was asleep, you know, and I went out there and watched him through that window until somebody ran me off.
Moving on to some other things. You, in the 60s, I mean, such a string of hits for Capitol, and Capitol had a whole West Coast setup, so you didn't ever really have to deal with Nashville at that time?
You know, Nashville really wasn't, I don't think it was not as big a deal as it is now.
Yeah, huh?
You know, and we were having, we were producing a different kind of music out there. We were producing a bar room that came mm-hmm. and dance music, and that was not even allowed in Tennessee. You know, I mean, the other side of the river was pretty white, you know, and they just didn't understand what we were doing. They didn't use drums, they didn't use horns, you know, and I really don't know how I got into country music back there,
mm-hmm.
but they accepted me as a country music artist and always had, and they paid me a lot of respect there, and I have a lot of friends, but it was not for me. I went back, tried to stay there 2 years, and my record sales went down, and as soon as I left, it went back, right back up, so I was probably selling to a lot of people in the industry there, and it got to be like old homeboy there, and they had me playing on everything all over town and singing mm-hmm. harmony with this guy, and you know, it became a fiasco, and I just left. But it's a different music altogether from the coast, and I don't think there's many similarities with between me and Porter Wagoner.
No,
even though I like his stuff and yeah. he likes mine. And,
well, that's, you just brought up a good thing, a good question to me. I mean, I've always, I'll see what you say to this. I always felt that you could have been a rock and roller. You could have been kind of a folk musician in a way, in that what you're singing, you were singing things that people were dealing with. There were topical songs all along the way. And as you say, there was barroom music. There was honky-tonk. And it's interesting that the whole California country, you and Buck Owens, and it was harder rockin'. I mean, Telecasters, you know, that was your instrument.
We were playing serious rock and roll when I broke into business. We were making a living at night in places where they expected that kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, I'm not sure, they put us in the country department at Capitol Records. I don't know why, but, and I guess it's good that they did, but you're right. I was doing Elvis's songs and Fats Domino and Chuck Berry and all that stuff at the clubs, and do a Lefty Frizzell song too,
mm-hmm.
you know. But you had to know everything in order to work in Bakersfield, because it was like Nashville wanted to be. You go to Nashville and all there was the Grand Ole Opry, had one show a week. We had 15 or 20 nightclubs and a television show that was reaching over maybe 3 million people at the very infancy of television. We were in their houses at the time that Cronkite was fixing to come on, prime time in the evening. And stars in Hollywood, actual movie stars like John Wayne, was watching our show. And, you know, they'd shake our hands and say, hey, we're big fans. You know, we go down and do a couple of films over the years, and these guys were more blown away with me than I was, and I couldn't believe what the impact we'd had in those early days. But that's how we got going out there.
Oh, totally. Jumping a little ahead to that, the song obviously that made you a household name for people who didn't follow you, even follow your music at all, had to be Okie from Muskogee, and a song that was an ironic song for you to record and kind of.
It really turned a lot of fans off of me.
Of your fans from before?
Yeah. And a lot of them didn't get it. Like, you know, it's that song was about my father, and he was the Okie from Muskogee. I was born in California, and there was a time when nobody knew anything about that Vietnam War, and it irritated the hell out of me for people to be acting the way they were acting. And I'd been to prison, I'd lost my freedom, and I was disgusted and appalled by the way these kids at the time were doing the flag, and I thought, you know, they don't know what they're doing. They've never lost it. And it really, it was an attempt to try to describe what I think my dad would have thought had he been alive at the time. Mm. And so that's where that came from.
Now, the first time you played that, apparently, it just galvanized the audience right away. Were you surprised?
They came out of the audience.
Wow.
We really wasn't a good test the first night because we were in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, mm. and playing for an officers club or something. And we'd had 8 or 9 hits. We had 8 or 9 number one records up to that time, and we were starting to go over into the pop field, and they were playing Take a Lot of Pride, and Dean Martin recorded it and everything. I was about to become a pop artist.
Hmm.
And when I did that song, well, it jumped out there and went right straight up through the Beatles and sold 2 million pieces in 90 days. Back then, that's a lot of records, you know. But it also lost the liberal side of my fan base. And it's taken me a lot of years for them to realize that there's more to me than Okie from Muskogee, you know.
Well, I've always seen you as a populist, and I think that probably sits pretty fair with you. You're for the working man.
Yeah, yeah. I try to say things I think that the people really want to, the majority of the people believe in. I don't try to go off one way or another too far, you know, unbelievably far to the left or right either way.
We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't take our trips on LSD. We don't burn our draft cards down on Main Street. 'Cause we like living right and being free.
Okie from Muskogee by Merle Haggard. He first released that song in 1969, and the interview you just heard was recorded in 2003, around the time Haggard put out Like Never Before. Thanks for joining us on this special 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe.